Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Right off the plane from New Orleans, Louisiana, into London, England, and live into your radio, or whatever the thing you're carrying, whatever your device. That's how we roll at this station, at this program. And inspired a bit, in at least the peripatetic mode, by a broadcaster, a true giant of broadcasting that we lost today, David Frost. I got to know him a little bit in the last few years, and quite a remarkable man. Very sad news. But there's less sad news from the journalism fraternity as well. 21st Century Fox, the media and entertainment company created when news corporations split in half to try to get those pesky, toxic newspapers out of the pond, has revealed the news that Chairman and CEO Rupert Murdoch has taken a loss in salary. He earned about $1.1 million less this fiscal year than in the previous year. Previous year was just over $30 million. Really? How many hours a week, babe? And this year, $28.9 million. And for 2011, it was $33.3 million. He had no comment on the officially about it, but if you want to know his feeling about it.
Of course one enjoys the feeling of power.
So that would sum that up. Forbes reported, by the way, this week that Rupert has purchased a 13-acre winery and mansion in Bel Air. A winery in Bel Air. Boy, when the neighbors see the people are going to be crushing the grapes, I think there may be trouble. But anyway, that's news of nice people doing nice things. Nice Corp. The news, of course, is dominated this weekend by the story of Syria and John Kerry doing the full Goldberg. It's William Goldberg, is that right? Who was Monica Lewinsky's attorney, the first man to do all five Sunday Yak shows. So now it's known as the full Goldberg. And he did all of them this Sunday morning, saying that the United States had to take military action against Syria, assuming Congress. Well, whatever Congress does. We'd love them to vote for it, but, you know, whatever Congress does. Because we have to uphold the international norm against the use of chemical weapons. On the subject, some news from outside the bubble. This is from Foreign Policy Magazine. In 1998, during the waning days of Iraq's war with Iran, the United States learned through satellite imagery that Iran was about to gain a major strategic advantage by exploiting a hole in Iraqi defenses. U.S. intelligence officials conveyed the location of the Iranian troops to Iraq, fully aware that Hussein's military would attack with chemical weapons, including sarin. The Iraqis had used mustard gas and sarin prior to four major offensives in early 1988 that relied on U.S. satellite imagery, maps, and other intel. These attacks helped tilt the war in Iraq's favor. This is Saddam Hussein's Iraq, ladies and gentlemen, and bring Iran to the negotiating table, ensuring the Reagan administration's longstanding policy of securing an Iraqi victory. They were the last in a series of chemical strikes stretching back several years the Reagan administration knew about and didn't disclose. According to recently declassified CIA documents and interviews with former intelligence officials, the U.S. had firm evidence of Iraqi chemical attacks beginning in 1983. The CIA has declined to comment for this story. And if you want to know how we regard other international norms, there is a convention, an international convention against torture, which requires that governments investigate and prosecute any allegations of torture by their citizens. Our position toward that norm is we're looking forward, not backwards. Hello, welcome to the show. Thank you.
that certain night, the night we met, there was magic abroad in the air. There were angels dining at the Ritz, and the nightingale sang. I may be right, I may be wrong, but I'm perfectly willing to swear that when you turn and smile at me, the nightingale sang in of town were paved with stars. It was such a romantic affair. And as we kissed and said goodnight, the nightingale sang in the streets of town were paved with stars. It was such a romantic affair. And as we kissed and said goodnight, a nightingale sang in
from London, England, not from Berkeley Square, from Leicester Square, where I think it's pigeons that sing. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of our friend the atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet.
Eddie, do you have jet lag?
I never get jet lag. I'm always lagged. I'm spinning so fast, I'm in permanent lag.
All right, then you should be used to it.
I am.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, you may or may not have heard this, but it's sort of conflicts with everything we've heard up to now. Radiation levels around a leaking tank at the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan are 18 times higher than originally thought.
Who says that?
Officials.
Official what?
New readings showed radiation levels high enough to give a lethal dose in as little as 4 hours.
So, leave after three.
The BBC's reporter on scene said new radiation monitoring equipment has revealed the true extent of the problem. They were using the wrong equipment.
50-50 chance.
The Vermont Yankee nuclear reactor will shut late next year and be decommissioned, its owner announced this week, citing low prices for natural gas and high operating costs. So it's not cheap enough?
I didn't say that.
This shutdown decision was made because this asset is not financially viable, said the owner, Entergy. The 40-year-old plant.
It's old enough to die, isn't it?
For a nuclear plant, I guess, which employs 630 workers, is on the Connecticut River near the border between Connecticut and Massachusetts during decommissioning, a process that could take decades to complete. We'll watch that.
Should be fun.
Yeah. Fuel will be transferred to storage. That's easy. The dangers presented by fires at French nuclear power stations must be taken very seriously after a report showed there were around 100 fire incidents at nuclear sites in just 2011. That's according to the National Nuclear Safety Regulator in France. Earlier this month, that regulator, ASN, published a report which said around 40% of the fire incidents reported at French nuclear sites were caused by electrical faults. It's ironic because the plants make electricity. California's nuclear energy industry has received four times more federal support than the state's distributed solar builders over a period six times as long, according to a new report. California's nuclear power suppliers have benefited from over $8.2 billion in subsidies over the last half century, according to Ask San Onofrio, a report by Nancy Fund and Noah Walker of a Silicon Valley firm. Distributed solar systems have earned $2.17 billion in tax credits or direct payments from the federal government. The 56-year-old Price Anderson Act's liability protection for nuclear plant operators and tax breaks for the decommissioning trust fund earnings. That's right. When nuclear plants set up decommissioning trust funds, like Vermont Yankee did, they get tax break on the earnings. Those together account for an estimated $164.1 million in annual federal support for the nuclear industry.
But it's cheap. And it's a free market.
The legislators who passed the Price-Anderson Act giving that subsidy and the tax break expected it to sunset, used as a verb by your congressional friends, after 10 years, yet it is now authorized through 2020.
It's 2020 vision, mister.
It is indeed. Clean, cheap, you can go back to spinning on your own time now, babe. Is clean, cheap, safe, too cheap to pimpin', our friend the Atom. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of another energy source, a couple of them. Actually, our friends in the fracking world. What the frack is going on? From Pennsylvania to North Dakota, a powerful argument for allowing extensive new drilling has been that royalty payments would enrich local landowners, lifting the economies of heartland and rural America. The boom was also supposed to fill the government's coffers, since 30% of the drilling takes place on federal land. So a lot of leases were signed. Hundreds of thousands of wells have been sunk into new energy deposits across the country. But according to Philly.com, manipulation of costs and other data by oil companies is keeping billions of dollars in royalties out of the hands of private and government landholders. They're quoting an investigation by ProPublica. An analysis of lease agreements, government documents, and thousands of pages of court records shows that such underpayments are widespread. Well, if you're going to underpay, don't just dabble in it. Thousands of landowners are receiving far less than they expected based on the sales value of gas or oil produced on their property. In some cases, they're being paid virtually nothing at all. In many cases, lawyers and auditors who specialize in production accounting told ProPublica energy companies are using complex accounting and business arrangements to skim profits off the sale of resources and increase the expenses charged to landowners. What do they think they are, movie companies? Deducting expenses is itself controversial and debated as unfair among landowners, but it is allowable under many leases, which were signed without landowners fully understanding their implications. Sounds like the movie business. But some companies deduct expenses for transporting and processing natural gas, even when the leases contain clauses explicitly prohibiting such deductions. In other cases, they withhold money without explanation for other unauthorized expenses and without telling landowners that the money is being withheld. I'll say it one more time. Sounds like the movie business. New geophysical research concludes that over 100 small earthquakes were triggered in a single year of fracking-related activities in one region of Ohio. That's according to New Scientist magazine. The Ohio quakes centered around Youngstown were triggered by the disposal of wastewater from fracking operations. That's where they inject the wastewater deep below, they hope, the water table. So it's not the pulling out of the gas, it's the pushing back in of the water after it's been wasted. The new research is the latest to suggest the main risk of earthquakes associated with fracking relates to the way the water used in the operations is disposed of afterwards. The wastewater in Ohio was injected into a deep well. This raised the pressure of water within the rock and triggered 109 small quakes. Scientists Brian Baptie of the British Geological Society says very few quakes are caused by the actual fracking, although that did occur in Blackpool and in Western Canada. Chemicals added to fracking water to aid the process may, of course, contaminate groundwater reservoirs, although they're higher. Methane leaks that researchers from the Cooperative Institute for Research and Environmental Sciences and from NOAA recorded range from 6 to 12% of annual production fracking wells. Worrisome because many researchers say if natural gas leaks at more than 3% overall, any climate change benefit from switching away from coal for electricity to gas will be lost. And while we're on the subject of chemical stuff, even the best national data on chemical accidents is wrong 9 times out of 10. A Dallas Morning News analysis of more than 750,000 federal records found pervasive inaccuracies and holes in data on chemical accidents, such as the one in West, the community of West, Texas, that killed 15 people and injured more than 300. In fact, no one at any level of government knows how often serious chemical accidents occur each year in the United States, and there is no plan in place for federal agencies to gather more accurate information. So there. Speaking of stuff we don't know, we passed this week the 8th anniversary of the flooding of New Orleans. There is no agency, private or public, that has ever bothered to gather information on the 100,000 people who were given one-way tickets out of New Orleans, evacuated involuntarily, mercifully at the time, but one-way tickets to 48 other states. Nobody knows how they're doing, whether they want to come back to New Orleans or not, whether they're doing better than they would have. So, you know, maybe in the next 2 years before the 10th anniversary, somebody might want to look into that. And speaking of New Orleans, if you read today's New York Times, there's a piece about something that you heard about on this show 3 or 4 weeks ago. And virtually every fact in the story you heard on this program 3 or 4 weeks ago, babe, specifically the lawsuit filed by the East Bank Levee Board in New Orleans against oil and gas companies for their decades of damage to the coastal wetlands. There is one piece of information the New York Times story didn't have. You may recall if you heard that interview with John Barry of the Levee Board on this broadcast, one of the things we talked about was the ferocious political response in Louisiana to the lawsuit, mainly by Republicans, starting with Governor Bobby Jindal. And I asked him at the time, well, what about the Democrats in Louisiana, assuming there are any left, have any come to the support of the lawsuit? And I specifically asked about the mayor of New Orleans, a city whose safety depends on the wetlands buffering incoming storms, storm surge and storm winds. And John Barry at the time said, you have to ask him. So, ladies and gentlemen, a week ago tomorrow, I was in New Orleans, and Mayor Mitch Landrieu was having a public town meeting. And I went to it, and I asked him, what's your stand on the levee board's lawsuit against the oil and gas companies? He didn't answer in person because I had left to go to dinner, so I emailed him later, and his email response was, people should help clean up the mess they make. That's a quote. So there you go. Is that a politician or what? But you can interpret it as meaning he supports the lawsuit. You're very welcome to do that. Or you can interpret it as being something a parent says. Anyway, little journalism there for your listening pleasure. Now, ladies and gentlemen, the Attorney General of New York has filed a lawsuit alleging fraud and deceitful practices against an institution I bet you didn't know existed. When, if you have a kid of college age, I bet this was not on the list of institutions that your son or daughter applied to. Perhaps. Trump University. I said Trump University. Part of the complaint by Eric Schneiderman, Attorney General of the state of New York, Trump University's hand-picked instructors, that's in quotes because that's what they were all advertised as being hand-picked by Donald Trump. They didn't know and this was all to teach you how to do real estate investing the way the master does. Those hand-picked instructors didn't know anything about real estate. Trump University, according to Schneiderman, repeatedly claimed that prospective students would be taught by successful real estate experts who were handpicked by Trump. In fact, respondents lacked substantiation for the claims that their instructors and mentors were successful real estate entrepreneurs. Not a single one was handpicked by Trump. Many came to Trump University from jobs having little to do with real estate. And some came to Trump University shortly after their real estate investing caused them to go bankrupt. Trump was a no-show. Trump University speakers repeatedly insinuated that Donald Trump would appear at the three-day seminar, claiming that he's going to be in town or often drops by or might show up or had just left. The students later discovered these claims were untrue. Rather than being photographed with Donald Trump, they were offered the chance to have their photo taken with a life-size photo of Donald Trump. Trump University pretended to be a school. Some instructors claimed that a Trump degree is a bit of a college degree, and that Trump offered graduate programs and doctorate programs. Furthermore, instructors routinely referred to themselves as faculty and to the program participants as students and then graduates. Trump didn't develop the curriculum. They were developed in large part by a third-party company that creates and develops materials for an array of motivational speakers and timeshare rental companies, according to the Attorney General. Trump University claimed that Donald Trump was not profiting from it, and founded it solely for philanthropic purposes, according to Trump University speakers. Students' payments would not go to Donald Trump. In fact, alleges the Attorney General, Donald Trump netted about $5 million in profit. When students reached the three-day seminar, they learned that contrary to what they'd been promised at free seminars, which were what hooked them in, they were not going to learn everything they needed to know to start investing. Instead, they were told they had to purchase additional programs to get the help they would supposedly need, what we call in the business an upsell. Trump University, ladies and gentlemen, sued by the state attorney general of New York. Now, they may not have a campus. They may not have a football team, although I hear they were applying to become a member of the Big One Conference. They may not have degrees, but they do have an alma mater.
Wisdom from your guilt. cord cut out, sealed inside you, cops and feds. Call me out, disciple us, be your motto through all the times of boom and slump. We remain your loyal consumers, University of Trump.
And they just all throw their degrees in the air, and it's a great ceremony. You should come attend sometime. The University of Trump's alma mater, ladies and gentlemen. Now, time for the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
First on our list of apologies this week, ladies and gentlemen, none other than top cable-rated Fox News Channel host, Bill O'Reilly.
Last night during my discussion with James Carville about the Martin Luther King commemoration, I said there were no Republican speakers invited. Wrong. It was wrong. Some Republicans were asked to speak. They declined, and that was a mistake. They should have spoken. Now, the mistake, entirely on me. I simply assumed that since all the speakers were liberal Democrats, Republicans were excluded. I'm sorry I made that mistake. It's very annoying because I know you guys watch The Factor for accuracy.
That would be called an Apollo brag, wouldn't it? I'm sorry, but I know you love me because I'm accurate. An Apollo brag, ladies and gentlemen. A neologism for your listening pleasure. And now, more apologies. Another 26 claims of clergy sexual abuse against priests with the Archdiocese of Dubuque, Iowa, have been settled for cases from the late 1940s through the 1970s. Iowa. The archdiocese paid a total of $5.2 million to the abuse survivors, 22 men and 4 women. The priests named in the latest group of claims served in schools, hospitals, colleges, convents, and parishes big and small. Archbishop Michael Jackals acknowledged the painful situation he inherited. "I am so sorry on so many levels," said Jackals, who was installed in the archdiocese in June. Install them. How many people does it take to install? Forget that. I even ask. I'm sorry this happened to people in vulnerable positions and at vulnerable ages that they were abused in this terrible way. That the person was a priest adds another level of horror to it because you should be able to trust a priest to protect you, not to be a perpetrator, unquote. Jackals, who worked with a handful of clergy sex abuse victims in Wichita when he was bishop there, promised to do, quote, everything humanly possible to make sure it doesn't happen again. He directed his officials to maintain strict screening and testing standards for prospective clergy candidates, quote, no matter how desperate we are for priests, unquote. Desperate for priests. Amid widespread calls for his resignation, Yellowstone County District Judge G. Todd Baugh apologized this week for saying a 14-year-old rape victim was, quote, older than her chronological age and as much in control of her situation as her attacker, unquote. Now, quoting him again, "I don't know how to pass that off," he told NBC News. "I'm saying I'm sorry, and it's not who I am. I deserve to be chastised. I apologize for that." This week, Baugh sentenced admitted rapist Stacey Rambold to 15 years, then suspended all but 31 days of the sentence. He, Rambold, a former high school teacher, pleaded guilty to the charge of sexual intercourse without consent with his then 14-year-old student. The victim committed suicide 2 years later. Dateline Sabatis, Maine, a retired police officer, is apologizing for a Facebook post that used a racial slur and suggested shooting President Obama. David Marsters of Sabatis, Maine, says Secret Service agents have been to his house and he's received anonymous death threats since a Maine newspaper first reported the threat. He says now he regretted making both the racial slur and the shooting reference. "I made a mistake," he said. "I said a stupid thing, and I apologize for it. I regret saying it. I didn't mean anything by it to hurt anybody. I apologize to the whole nation." He's resigned from all of his official posts. Sony apologized for a leak at Grand Theft Auto of the Grand Theft Auto 5 assets The leak included details on the open world game's main theme and soundtrack. I don't know what open world game means, but I said it. We sincerely apologize to Rockstar and Grand Theft Auto fans across the world who were exposed to the spoiler content, Sony said in the official blog. That's almost an Apollo brag. 3 months after a chemical explosion rocked the small town of Seward, Illinois, more than 100 residents packed the Seward School gym to ask questions about what happened. I don't think any of us residents knew the dangerous type of chemicals that were being dealt there, said a resident. The president of NovaChem, Reno Novak, apologized to residents for the explosion and the inconvenience of being evacuated from their homes for nearly 2 full days. It was a bad day for everyone, Novak told the crowd. It's a bad chem day. He did try to explain how the dangerous chemicals at the plant were. Dangerous is a relative word, he said. Is gasoline dangerous? Sure it is, under the wrong conditions. He noted there were no harmful effects we've been able to detect within the facility and the surrounding area. So, go home. He didn't say that. I interpolated that for him. English cricketers have issued an official apology on the England and Wales Cricket Board's website amid the allegations that English players, during their celebrations for the win against Australia in a series known as the Ashes, during their celebrations, I say, that they urinated on the field, known as a pitch. The allegations were neither negated nor accepted by the proclaimed defenders or the English Cricket Board. The statement says, the English cricket team would like to state that during our celebrations after winning the Ashes, at no time was there any intention to disrespect the Oval, which is the name of the cricket ground, or anyone else involved in the game we love. As a team, we pride ourselves in respecting all things cricket, including the opposition and the grounds we play at. We got carried away amongst the euphoria of winning such a prestigious series and accept that some of our behavior was inappropriate. If that has caused any offense to anyone, we apologize for that and want to reassure people that it was a simple error of judgment more than anything else, unquote. An if apology, ladies and gentlemen. The incident was reported by Australian journalists, well, Sour Grapes Department, Sour Koalas Department, who claimed to be eyewitnesses. The incident took place after 5 hours of the match when the stadium... 5 hours. You know, after a five-hour match, you could be excused for... being desperate. The stadium was empty and only working staff were there. Three players were named in the offense. One player also validated the story in the English tabloid The Sun, owned by Rupert Murdoch, saying, we did go out to the middle of the pitch, all the lads drinking beers, singing a few songs and enjoying each other's company. I think the call of nature might have come once or twice, but it was nothing untoward. It was midnight, a private celebration in the middle of the pitch, and the ground was dark and eventually wet. He didn't say the last part there, but that's in a Rupert Murdoch tabloid, so...
Of course one enjoys the feeling of power.
And Dateline Yokota Air Base in Japan, General Mark Welsh III apologized this week to Air Force personnel who were furloughed this year as a result of the sequester. I don't care whether you wear a uniform or wear a suit to work, he told airmen and civilian personnel. You're all in our Air Force. Those of you who do wear a suit to work and have been furloughed this year, I apologize. I'm sorry that we as a nation didn't figure out a way to do this better. That's an Apollo speech. That's an Apollo rant. I can't stop myself this week, ladies and gentlemen. I'm neologizing up the old... And Dunkin' Donuts has apologized after it ran an advertisement in Thailand featuring a woman in blackface makeup. The ad, which was used to promote the donut firm's charcoal donut, was called bizarre and racist by Human Rights Watch. Dunkin' Donuts' chief executive in Thailand defended the campaign, but a spokesman for Dunkin' Brands told the Guardian newspaper it would immediately pull the planned television commercial featuring the imagery. Dunkin' Donuts recognizes the insensitivity of this spot, and on behalf of our Thailand franchise and our company, we apologize for any offense it caused. According to Karen Raskopf, chief communications officer for Dunkin' Brands, we're working with our franchisee to immediately pull the television spot and change the campaign. The CEO for Dunkin' in Thailand said, it's absolutely ridiculous. We're not allowed to use black to promote our donuts? I don't get it. What's the big fuss? What if the product was white and I painted someone white? Would that be racist? The official said his daughter was the model used in the ad. He dismissed criticism as paranoid American thinking, saying, I'm sorry, but this is a marketing campaign, and it's working very well for us. Not really an apology there, but, you know, from headquarters, yes, an apology. Thank you very much. The apologies of the week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, the program is back on the radio in Los Angeles, but there was a three-month period, an interregnum, during which we were not heard in the Los Angeles area on radio. And so this week, I'm going to reprise a few things you might have missed if you were in Los Angeles in that point in time. All apropos of stuff that's still going on. So, for example, we heard last week on this program that NSA officials used NSA spying tools to spy on their loved ones. Well, now we learned the practice wasn't frequent, according to the Wall Street Journal, but common enough to garner its own spycraft label, LoveInt. You know, that they call human intelligence HUMINT and satellite or telephone signals intelligence SIGINT. So this is LoveInt. This is these constitute most of the episodes of willful misconduct by NSA employees, according to the agency itself. They involved overseas communications such as spying on a partner or spouse. In each case, the employee was punished either with an administrative action or termination. Most of the incidents were self-reported. Such admissions can arise, for example, when an employee takes a polygraph test as part of a renewal of a security clearance. Yes, your NSA relies on polygraph tests. Even though, in a test case aimed at deterring polygraph instructors who teach people how to avoid being busted by a polygraph, U.S. prosecutors have urged a judge to sentence Chad Dixon to 1 year and 9 months in prison, citing a career of teaching those techniques to intelligence employees and law enforcement applicants, as well as child molesters. Authorities assert Chad Dixon crossed the line between free speech and criminal conduct when he told some of his clients to conceal what he taught them while undergoing government polygraphs. And from the Wall Street Journal as well. Yeah, Rupert, I know you're happy, even though I didn't pay for it. For the 2002 Winter Olympics in Salt Lake City, officials say that the Federal Bureau of Investigation and NSA arranged with Quest Communications, the phone company that covers that area, to use intercept equipment for a period of less than 6 months around the time of the event, the Winter Olympics. The NSA and FBI monitored the content of all email and text communications in the Salt Lake City area during that six-month period. It's a new world we live in, ladies and gentlemen, and it's secret.
Date, a charming rescue stray. stored in a secret database. Then for secret reasons, foul or pure, someone punches save and not erase. Welcome to the United States of Secret, where your loyalty card is worth as much as gold. Our leaders have a right to remain so silent. You never come in out of the cold.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to read the trains for you. Who else? You know what I'm saying? Ombudsman's critique of NPR series prompts rebuke from top brass. You know I'm going to read it for you, don't you? I think you do. NPR's ombudsman published an in-depth report early last month, harshly criticizing an award-winning 2011 investigative series that has now prompted a rebuke from NPR executives who stand by the journalism in the series. The NPR News investigation in question, oh, this is from Current, the trade magazine of public broadcasting, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, since you asked. You did, didn't? That was you, wasn't it? The NPR News investigation in question, Native Foster Care, Lost Children, Scattered Families, examined the treatment of Native American children in South Dakota's foster care system. It aired on Morning Edition, all things considered. The reports alleged that South Dakota's government had violated the federal Indian Child Welfare Act and profited by taking children from families. It featured emotional testimony from Native kids, grandmothers, and tribal officials. In his detailed examination of the series, NPR's ombudsman argued that the story was, well, argued, yes, all right, we'll use their verb, that the story was unfair. He found the story was unfair, inaccurate, and misleading, and that it fell short of backing up key allegations about the state's actions. My finding is that the series was deeply flawed and should not have been aired as it was, wrote NPR's ombudsman. In a response posted on NPR's website, K. Kinsey Wilson, Executive VP and Chief Content Officer. How are you enjoying your content today, by the way? And Senior Vice President for News, Margaret Lowe Smith, acknowledged errors and shortcomings in the series, but they declined to provide a point-by-point response to the ombudsman's critique. Quote, NPR stands by the stories. In re-examining the series, we found the reporting to be sound. They said. The executives found fault, in turn, with the ombudsman's investigation. The process surrounding the ombudsman's inquiry was unorthodox, the sourcing selective, the fact-gathering uneven, and many of the conclusions, in our judgment, subjective or without foundation, they wrote. And they added, quote, the ombudsman's interaction with state officials over the past 22 months has impeded NPR's ability to engage those officials in follow-up reporting, unquote. Says Bob Collins, a blogger for Minnesota Public Radio, it is an astonishing piece of journalism about an astonishing piece of journalism. I've never seen any ombudsman report to be this complete and comprehensive, says Jeffrey Dworkin, NPR's first ombudsman. NPR's rejection of the ombudsman's criticism was also, he said, unusually strong. Isn't that wacky? A wacky little thing you discover, ladies and gentlemen, that sometimes you can just denounce your ombudsman and say they're screwing up your journalism. Something we discover when I read the trades for your copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And, on the subject of secrecy, we know that the DNI, James Clapper, testified before Congress earlier this year and later apologized. Well, he didn't apologize. He explained that the lack of truthfulness of his testimony was because he'd been asked a sort of an impossible question to answer and that he hadn't lied, but he had just given the least untruthful answer. And shortly thereafter, Larry King, who's just got a new television series on RT, the Russian-owned TV channel, had an interview that was right on point. Back here in this wonderful new studio, RT has built me, makes CNN look like Sid's Deli on Rivington Street. Tomorrow on the program, a very important panel with Carl Woodward and Vladimir Putin. Right now, here in our Los Angeles studio, an old friend of every show I've had since the all-night radio thing, the former lead singer of the boy band Smash of the 90s, Boys Are Us, Dewey Gordon. Dewey, welcome to the new show.
Thanks, Mr. King. I gotta say, lucky I didn't know the Russians had studios like this during my boy band days. I might have defected.
Hey, best borscht in town right downstairs.
Ah, that's the beet thing, right?
Hey, you're all about the beet. So, Dewey,
yeah,
you're looking younger and better than ever. What you been up to?
Well, Mr. King, I've been away for about 6 months having a life peel.
Huh? What's that?
It's a face peel done by a life coach, and I have to tell you, I just feel not just refreshed, but actually fresh.
That's great. Now, your band reunited a while back. How's that going?
Well, some of the guys are in rehab, some are in dehab, so I just thought it's maybe the right time to rekindle my solo ambitions.
Now, you've always brought us preview copies of your solo efforts. Is that why you're here tonight?
Well, of course, I'm here just to touch base with you, Mr. King. But yeah. Yes, I do have a song I've been in the studio working on with my wicked great producer, DJ Booth. And it's a song we wrote this week after we saw all the hassle the spy guy got for testifying in the Congress.
That's James Clapper?
I guess that's his name. Mm. But people were on his butt for him saying that his testimony was his least untruthful answer, and yet something about that just rang very almost true for me. So this is that song.
All right, we're going to hear it now?
Unless you cut me off.
We wouldn't do that to you.
Yes, sir. It's called Least Untruthful Answer.
All right, the great Dewey Gordon.
You don't have to lie to me. Don't have to tell the truth. All I want to hear is what you're saying. 'Cause when I stop believing, it's like when I lose a tooth. And hoping that it's so, it's just like praying. So speak with lots of fibers of your being. Fight disbelief, it's another form of cancer. What I want to know from you is more than I can know. It's only that my ignorance is showing. So when I ask you questions, don't let it bring you down. It only means I'm staying instead of going. Like a dancer, don't need a stack of Bibles, don't even need to swear on one. Just give me your least untruthful answer. Give me your least untruthful answer. My faith in you, it can't be tarnished. The truth looks better when it's varnished. When it's varnished. So speak with lots of fibers of your being. It's another form of cancer. Let me know there aren't that many shadows of a doubt. Please give me your least untruthful answer. Give me your least untruthful answer.
Dewey Gordon, we got just a couple of seconds, Dewey. You going to be performing anywhere?
Well, sir, if enough people are watching this, you never know.
Thanks, pal. Till tomorrow from RT in Hollywood, good night.
Gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time, over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the East Coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet. On the Mighty 104 in Berlin, on your smartphone through Stitcher.com, available as a free podcast at KCRW.com. And SideshowNetwork.com and iTunes and SoundCloud.com. And it'll be just like you checking out episode one of Honey, What's With Honey Poo Poo on YouTube or on MyDamnChannel.com if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. The tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Exile in Hawaii desks. Thanks as always to Pam Halstead. Thanks to Adrian Bodnam here at Global Radio in London for help with today's broadcast. And I'm, as always, on Twitter, at The Harry Shearer. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions. It originates through the facilities of the Change Is Hard Radio Network. So long from London.